Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the challenges of presenting one of the best-known and best-loved musicals of the past 35 years in a way that allows audiences to connect with it in new ways? Director Liesl Tommy, who last month won an Obie Award for her work on the off-Broadway production Appropriate, came to Texas this summer to direct the Dallas Theater Center's staging of Les Miserables. She joins us now to talk about how she translated her understanding of the original Victor Hugo novel and of its musical iteration into something that feels both familiar and very new. Liesl, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris, for having me.
How did you start thinking about what you wanted to do with this show when you signed on to direct it?
Well, I've never seen any production of Les Mis. I've never seen the Broadway show or a tour or even, you know, a high school version of it. So I came to it with probably the freshest eyes possible. And I did think about maybe going to see it, but then I changed my mind and I thought I would use it to my advantage, that I had no preconceived notions of what it should look like. And that really freed me up to just think about the story. And as a person who develops a lot of new plays and new musicals, that is how you approach everything first, is you think about the story, you think about the arc and the characters. And I kind of approached it like it was a new play. And so I asked the questions that I always ask, which is, what makes this play relevant in the 21st century? What are the images that I think are the most resonant, that the audience is going to respond to in the most visceral way, that will make them really understand the essence of what a story or a scene or a character is going through? And that's where I got to some of the more, I guess you could call them, untraditional parts of this version of the production. And it was just really thinking about how a 21st century audience is going to connect in the most immediate and powerful way.
Given what you do for a living, the fact that you had never seen a production feels like a deliberate choice. Like, before you ever came to direct this, were you like, I am not going to see that stupid show. Everybody's done it under the sun.
No, it actually wasn't. It's just one of, you know, everybody has those shows where they're like, it's the kind of guilty secret. You know, I've never seen Cats, or I've never seen Les Mis, or I've never seen Phantom of the Opera. You know, there's always that one thing that people have never seen, and that it just happened for me to be Les Mis. It was not intentional, because I think the music is incredible. I think, and I love the Victor Hugo novel. So it was just purely an oversight.
It's frustrating sometimes when you read the novel and you already have a lot to deal with in the hours that you put the musical on, but there's a lot that's not in it from the novel. Were there things that informed, in the back of your mind as a director, that don't appear on stage but that you wanted to be really conscious of?
Well, you know, it's funny because there was a period where Nahal Joshi, the actor playing Jean Valjean, and I would talk about what was not in the novel. What was in the novel and not in the play, because there was so much, there's so much rich material. You know, and the Jean Valjean struggle is so incredibly complex and drawn out in the novel. And, you know, we finally kind of had to come to terms with the differences and the separateness, and let our understanding of the novel inform and infuse the work we were doing. But we had to let it go and just focus on the script in front of us.
So modern dress, talk about how you arrived at that. Did you know from the outset, okay, here's a way to make it feel really different?
You know, my intention was never really about how to make it feel really different. My intention was, again, to just figure out how to connect to a contemporary audience in a way that really grabbed their imagination. Because sometimes I feel like when you kind of just give everybody what they've seen before with the period costumes, then they don't think about it in a new way, or they don't go any deeper than they have to. And I didn't want this story to feel like a kind of romantic fairy tale period costume piece. I wanted it because its themes are so relevant today. You know, the themes of revolution, of familial love, of desperation, of trying to build a civil society that we can all take pride in, the struggle with spirituality, all of these things are very, very immediate. It's everything, not only in this country, but all around the world. I'm lucky enough to get to work internationally, that people are struggling with everywhere. And so I really wanted the audience to feel like this is a play about them, not a play about people in France in the 1830s.
I was struck, as we were discussing before the show, in the opening scenes, you see the people who many people have seen the show. You see the prisoners, and then, of course, they're being guarded by prison guards, and you have a sort of a caricature is the wrong word, but you have police in riot gear, like full riot gear, and they're very menacing. And they have these big weapons that I hadn't associated with that. And there was a brutality to it that I had never felt before in any of the multiple productions I had seen. Very good productions, but I just never had that feeling in that scene before.
Yeah, I mean, what I was looking for is this is a musical that is about oppression, brutality, extreme poverty, because what are the circumstances that create revolution in a society? It's not a sense of peace. It's not a sense of equality. It's not a sense of everybody, you know, having their needs fulfilled or their civil rights met. No, what leads to revolution is a feeling of oppression and deprivation. And so, when you do the research in terms of what was happening in France that led to a revolution, and I come from South Africa originally. I grew up during the apartheid era. What was going on in my country that led to resistance every decade, demonstrations, violence, uprising, and what's happening in our world right now in the Middle East, you know, with Arab Spring. What are the circumstances that lead to people who would much rather go about their daily lives, putting their lives and their families' lives at risk to stand up for a cause? What are those things? And it's always about a feeling of oppression. And so I tried to figure out how to physicalize what was already in the play, in the musical, in the book, to make it feel as relevant as possible to us today. So I just really dug deep into the story and mined it. And, you know, it's my job to come up with the most dramatic, specific, and accurate visual images to tell the story as effectively as possible. And that's what I came up with for that the prison sequence. And throughout the play is just a really menacing view of the state, an oppressive state, because that's what people were living in. They were living under an oppressive state that was not where people's rights were being deprived. So that's how I got to the police and riot gear image.
What kind of conversations did you have with the folks who were designing the costumes and the lighting and the set?
It was an incredibly rich process with the set and the costume designer. John Coyne and Jacob Clymer, who did the set and costumes respectively. John and I had, there was a video clip of a demonstration in South Africa that was on YouTube that I showed everybody. That was sort of like my starting point. And it's a lot of that is in the play in terms of the finale, the movement and the energy of that demonstration. And, you know, we talked about sort of third world oppression, and we talked about first world oppression, and we talked about third world poverty, first world poverty. We talked about what an audience in Dallas, because, you know, whenever I work somewhere, I think specifically about the audience in the city I'm in. That's why it's so fun to travel and direct, because you really get to think about the place you're in. And I really thought about what an audience in Dallas might connect to, what an audience in Dallas might be moved by, what they might reject. And so John and I, the set designer, talked a lot about, what are images of oppression and images of poverty, and what are images central images that could really tell the story, that we were wanting to tell. And he found some amazing research and then just kind of distilled all of the conversations into this one incredibly powerful, intimidating and inspiring design. And it's been a joy to work on that set. It's really more of an environment than a set. You know, it's so rich, and it can transform as needed. You know, it can feel exactly like a prison, like a maximum security prison, or it can feel like a shanty town, or it can feel like a mansion, and that's really kind of glorious. And the costume designer and I had a really intense process, where I started to talk about the idea of some more contemporary images, that it could be a mix of period and contemporary. And he created a whole packet of designs that had that idea, that were incredibly beautiful. And as we looked at them all laid out, every single character, sketches, I said, you know what, I think you have to go back to the drawing board and you have to make it even more contemporary, because it felt like we were trying to kind of hedge our bets and play it safe. And I said, I think we have to take, you know, we have to go further. And he was just so incredibly available, and he went back to the drawing board, and he just pushed the ideas that we had talked about, and, you know, made really brave artistic choices. And, you know, we were both nervous about a backlash and people wanting to see what they always saw, but, you know, we approached it with as much commitment to the story as possible and to the vision, which was to make it as immediate as we can. And that's where we got to with the costumes. And I think they're incredibly beautiful. And like the set, there's just so much nuance and specificity and artistry in them. So it's been a gift to be able to work with these artists on this particular show.
You have a raked stage for this show, which is not a common thing these days. Talk about that decision.
Yeah, for you listeners out there who don't know what that is, it means that the stage is not flat. It's at an angle. So from the back of the stage to the audience, there's a pretty steep angle, which means that the actors have to, you know, run around with guns and do dance numbers. And in the case of Cosette and Madame Thénardier, prance around in very high heels on this rake. And it's definitely challenging, but, you know, that's what actors train for. They are, you know, very physically fit and flexible. And so for me, it just helps me make amazing stage pictures, because I don't have to worry about people blocking each other. Everything's at an angle. So the composite, my ability to compose is, you know, kind of opened up enormously. So that's why I'm excited about the rake.
And is it right that all stages or most stages used to be tilted in that way?
Yeah, that actually is true. And it's when you work on, I've worked on a few rakes, it's, you can see why, because it makes your job easier. But I don't think everybody loves to work on a rake.
Did you worry at all about injuries, that sort of thing?
Yeah, of course. But, you know, these people are trained. They're professionals. They know how to take care of themselves. And also the theater made sure that we brought a chiropractor in to work with everybody on the very first day so that you knew how to use their body. So, you know, there's certainly precautions that we always take.
I was fascinated by the casting choices that you made, and I feel like they all worked really well. But in terms of the types that we associate with particular characters, and in particular Jean Valjean and Fantine, they're very different from what we think we know those characters to be.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. People keep saying that. I directed a production of Hamlet a couple of years ago, and people said the same exact thing to me, and they kept asking for my concept around casting, and I had no concept around casting. I am a person of color, and I'm a person of, you know, my background is African, it's European, it's Asian, Indian, Indonesian, the whole thing. It's all in there. And I come from a community that's as mixed as that. So I just see the world in many different ways. I don't think that a romantic lead has to have blonde hair and blue eyes to be a romantic lead. I don't think that an ingenue, you know, needs to be a tiny, little Barbie doll type. It's just not how I see the world. And so, you know, I'm lucky enough to be able to bring my view of the world onto my stage. And so when I was casting, I asked the casting director, the incredible people that I worked with at Bernie Telsey Casting in New York, who do a lot of musicals, to bring me the most diverse, most interesting people, and of course the best voices. Because, you know, the other
at
thing
at the end I, of the day it has
yeah,
to
yeah it's got yeah. You know, no matter how well, I also thought if I had the most amazing transcended voices, then people would let me do whatever I wanted to do conceptually, because they wouldn't be disappointed by that. So they brought me, you know, people who've done this musical on Broadway, on the tours.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is director Liesl Tommy. The Dallas Theater Center production of Les Miserables runs through August 17th. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Do you hear singing the song of angry men. It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drums, there is a life about to start when tomorrow comes. Join in our crusade, who will be strong and stand with me. Beyond the barricade, is there a world you long to see? Then join in the fight, it will give you the right.
That was John Campion as Angel Ross, joined by the chorus for Do You Hear the People Sing? That was a rehearsal of Les Miserables earlier this month at the Dallas Theater Center. We're speaking with its director, Liesl Tommy. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. What are the challenges when you are working with a musical where absolutely every line of dialogue is sung in terms of the freedom with which people can express themselves? Is there like a weird muscle memory of people having heard other cast recordings in the past that you have to deal with?
Yes. I mean, you know, a musical like this, you basically have to give over about a week of your rehearsal to the music director so that they can teach every single bit of music to the cast. It's, you know, it's an incredible volume of music. On the plus side of this process, most of the cast had already, you know, committed this music to memory at some point in their lives. So a lot of people came in knowing the music. And, you know, there was a point where the incredible music director, Sinai Tabak, said to the cast, please stop listening to the recordings. Mm-hmm. Please stop listening to, you know, all of the millions of recordings that are out there, and start hearing the music in a fresh way and hearing yourself sing it in a more personal and more specific to our show way. Because, you know, those sounds are very specific to those shows. And so you kind of have to slowly release them, which is not to say that what we're doing sounds enormously different, but it's, you know, it's the phrasing and the orchestration and the acting is specific to our show. And so we have to start investing in the scene work that we're doing between our actors and our interpretation of the storytelling. And so there, you know, you definitely have to release what you think you know about the musical, and let it start to have its own energy and chemistry. And, you know, that's been kind of one of the joys of watching this project unfold, is just seeing how these actors take ownership of their characters and the story.
What about timing? Because so much of that would seem to be prescribed by the pace of the score.
Yeah, no, I mean, no doubt. But, you know, unlike other plays, especially new plays or especially kind of big epic plays that I've worked on, where you obsess about runtime, you know, oh, God, act one is just too long. And, hopefully we can shave off this many minutes. We don't have to worry about that because it is as long as it is, as long as the score is. So you don't, act one is like an hour and a half, and act two is, you know, an hour and five, and that is just what it is. That's how long the music takes, and that's how long the play takes. There's nothing I can do to make it longer. And that's kind of a relief to not have to think that it's on my shoulders to shave down the time. It's just that's how long it is. And, you know, and the audiences know that, and they expect that. And I think they'd feel cheated if it was any shorter, frankly, because people love it so much. So
I've read that in interviews where you discussed other shows that you've directed, that you really like to let the actors sort of decide where they will be, and you give them some guidance, but you really want to open things up for them. Is that different when you're working on a musical, or is it the same kind of process?
Well, I always, you know, when we first rehearse a scene, I always kind of let them go. Just put them on stage and let them do what they do. And then I watch what their bodies are doing, what their impulses are. And that's how I kind of learn where their head is, you know, how they're thinking about something. And, you know, then I'll get in and I will shape things. But I always first take my cues from how the actor's moving. And, you know, and some actors are incredibly intuitive and in their bodies and know how to be on stage and understand the events of a scene And you know, you can really build off of them. And some actors are less experienced, or just that's not how they think about it. And you really have to tell them, go here, go here, go there. But you know, there's every actor is different. Every actor brings their own set of gifts. And so that's not, you know, that's not a concern. It's just about learning how they think and move and how they imagine is the first step for me. Because I am a kind of I like an actor-driven performance. That's really my preference. So I really like to give them a lot of room. I mean, with this musical, I also have, I'm working with Christopher Windham, who's the choreographer who I've worked with many, many times, and I'm a great admirer of his work. So it's a little bit different with, you know, when you bring choreography, though he is an incredibly organic choreographer. It is, you know, a little bit different because it is about this, these are the steps and you have to learn them. And, you know, it's more structured in a musical in terms of movement. That's for sure. So, but what I always like a sense of freedom. I want the audience to feel like what they're watching is very free and a little bit dangerous and you know, and has a kind of a heartbeat to it that is its own animal. And the choreographer has that same kind of preference. And so even though things are choreographed, there is a sense of wildness to the movement, a freedom to the movement. And you know, and that sounds like an easy thing to achieve, but in some ways I think it's harder to stage a sense of freedom. Because it has to be very disciplined.
Yeah,
the creation of it has to be very disciplined.
You have to move in the same place every time, or you're going to crash into somebody else,
exactly.
Or it's going to be awkward, or yeah,
right. But it's really about how you communicate to the how you get the actor to think about it, so that sense of wildness and danger is palpable. So that takes a little bit more work than just pot of beret, kickball change, that kind of thing. So
once you are running full scenes and then the entire show, and you're sort of giving notes afterwards, what does it take to make sure that, I mean, you want to focus on the principal action within the scene, but you also need to notice if somebody doing something awkward sort of in the background, you need to pay attention to that too. Do you have a specific process for being sure that your eye has fallen on everything happening?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, you know, this is where where you really rely on your collaborators during the preview process, because you know the way I experience it is that you there's definitely things at the forefront that you're focusing on, obsessing over, right, in preview one, preview two, preview three, and then you take care of those things, and then you watch it, and then the next group of concerns rise up to take their place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so while I may be focusing entirely on the principles in the first three previews, we deal with those issues, and then you watch the next two previews, and then you can obsess over the next level of storytelling, so that by the time you get to opening, I have this epically long work list that I tackle every day of rehearsal when we have a preview. It's just about systematically chipping away at the work list and not getting panicked about running out of time, and not getting panicked about not getting to everything. You just really have to have faith that if you approach it in an orderly fashion, with discipline and specificity, you will hit every single concern on. And sometimes, especially in the beginning, the list is massive. And this is when the lighting designer and I work the most closely, because and Colin K. Bills, who's the lighting designer, again, another person I've worked with a lot. I tend to work with the same designers because we have a shorthand and we can get enormous amounts of things accomplished in a short amount of time. He has an incredible eye for detail and I really think of the way that he lights is like a painter. You know, his artfulness in terms of sculpting light and creating worlds just with light is pretty astounding. But this is when he and I work the most intensely together. I kind of let him do his thing during the actual tech process, which is where we put all of the cues together. But then when we get to previews, that's when we're kind of really kind of sculpting the ends of moments. You know, are we landing the last breath of that song exactly how we want to land it? You know, should the light go out here? Should the light go out there? Or he'll come to me and he'll say, I think the way the actor's moving in that transition could be faster or slower so that we can, light them more beautifully this way, or we can disguise that enormous set transition that's got to happen, where 10 pieces of furniture you have to get moved off in 2 seconds. So this is sort of the most tedious, but also the most exhilarating part of the process, because you get so much done that creates the kind of magic. And this is the stuff that a regular audience will have no clue we're obsessing over, you know. You know, if you listen to our notes sessions after a preview, we're talking about, like, we were really talking for a long time about whether to move that bench on here, whether to move that bench on there, and what's the lighting cue doing that, and what are those stagehands doing, and, you know, it's kind of crazy how intensely we kind of and relentlessly we pursue perfection in a moment.
Well, because by the time you get to previews, you've only got so many chances to say, all right, try it there. No, actually,
correct,
take it back. It didn't work. So you have to be pretty close to what you want.
That's exactly right. So it's previews are a time for refining, but they're also a time for taking risks. You know, like with I've had conversations with both the Nihal Joshi, who plays Jean Valjean, and Ed Watts, who plays Javert, about things that we're trying, you know, things that we're not sure about. And, you know, they're such pros that they'll just go, let's give it a try in previews and see how we like it. And, you know, there's some people who just, like, an audience comes in and it's just, let's just try to make as safe and clean a choice as possible. And then there's some actors who are like, let's give it a go and see what happens. If they hate it, they hate it, and then we can talk about it. But that's what's so great about getting a chance to have as many previews as we have on the show, is that you really can explore. And that is what art is. It's not about getting it right. It's about exploring and finding the best, most truthful moment. You cannot skip the exploration stage.
Did you begin your career as a director when you were sort of training yourself to do this by doing it? Were you that organized in the beginning, or is it something that you've sort of figured out how to do over time?
You know, it's funny. I started off as an actor, mm-hmm. And I went to Trinity Rep Conservatory in Rhode Island and studied acting. And when I moved to New York, I was pursuing my acting career. Though I had directed in the past, but I reached a point where I realized that, you know, the kind of theater I like to make, the political, you know, important, relevant stuff, you don't get to choose that as an actor. You just kind of have to take what they offer you.
And like, thank God I can pay the rent this month.
Exactly. Yeah. And I just like, I can't imagine spending my whole life just like hoping that I get something interesting. So I started to, you know, I sought out playwrights that I thought were doing interesting, you know, compelling work. And then that's how I kind of got my directing career going. But I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder because I didn't have a formal directing training, and I was terrified that people wouldn't know that. So I became just hyper obsessive about all of the details, because I was afraid I was going to like let something slip, and then people would go, you shouldn't be directing, you're just an actor. But in the end, it's really served me well, because, you know, it's a really joyous process. It's very orderly, but it also, you know, I just get the work gets done, and I don't have to lose my mind and freak out in tech rehearsals like I remember some directors doing a lot, you know, screaming and throwing things.
You're right.
And, it, you know, for me, that's how I want it to be. I want everybody to be having a fun time, but I also want everybody working harder than they've ever worked in their life, because that's how you really get the gold on stage. That's where you know, I gave an intense talk to the cast a couple of days ago, where I basically said, you know, when you're working on this kind of project where it's about life and death, where people, we're telling stories that people in the audience have experienced. People in the audience have experienced death. They've experienced grief. They've experienced loss. They've experienced true love. And they've experienced moments of desperation in their lives, and moments of bleakness. And we have the privilege of sharing those moments of common humanity with them. And if we're not giving everything, we are not doing our jobs. And I really believe that. I really believe that it's our jobs to like dig as deep as possible so that the audience can get as rich an experience as possible. That's the exchange, the audience performer exchange. And it's like, to me, an ironclad contract.
Another really fascinating theme about this work, whether you're looking at the novel or the musical or there have been some movies, it's about people believing they're doing the right thing. Sometimes that varies according to circumstance, and sometimes it doesn't. But people can have just vastly different interpretations of what the word right mm-hmm. actually means.
Mm-hmm. That is definitely true. I mean, it's something that we talked a lot about with the character of Javert.
Such a thankless role and very well performed.
I know.
In this, but it's, you know, if it's well
performed.
Done, you hate him.
You do hate him. And then I think by the end, you find compassion for him, which is really, you know, that's the arc that you want. But I think, you know, he's doing a fantastic job because you don't want an actor who's afraid of the audience hating you, mm-hmm. who's going to like soft pedal it so that they love him. Because you have to really kind of just be so angry at him for, you know, not leaving our hero alone. But the thing is, you know, the thing that's so fascinating to me about Javert and Jean Valjean, you know, is the way that their spirituality is portrayed in this musical, because both men are deeply spiritual people. And Javert, you know, his sense of spirituality is and religion is much more kind of dogmatic and rigid. Whereas Jean Valjean's is a hard-won spirituality. You know, it came from absolute despair. It came from a place of feeling abandoned by God and probably not really believing in God. And just through struggle and through moment of utter desperation, someone reaches out and helps him find his own internal strength and his own faith. And, you know, I think that's so powerful to be able to track these two very different men's journey through faith. And the one who thought that the most rigid interpretation of religion was the answer is the one who kind of falls apart at the end, as opposed to the one who had no religion and found it through just failure, mistakes, and human growth. That is much more real. That is really how human beings in the world actually are. And I think it's a terrible, puts a terrible burden on people to think that, you know, there's only one way to be. And if you don't be that way, you're a failure, because everybody fails. We are all failures. I was saying this to the cast the other day as well. We are, as human beings, we are united in our failure.
We just can't admit it.
No, we can't admit it. And I just think that, you know, to tap into compassion, we have to accept that.
My guest is director Liesl Tommy. Les Miserables at the Dallas Theater Center runs through August 17th. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
That was Alison Blackwell singing I Dreamed a Dream as Fantine at a recent rehearsal of Les Miserables, which runs at the Dallas Theater Center through August 17th. My guest is director Liesl Tommy. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we have Gwen on the line in Dallas. Hi, Gwen.
Oh, hi. This is a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now, I was interested, and I'm sorry, I've missed part of the conversation, so I don't have the director's name.
Liesl Tommy.
Liesl Tommy. Okay, thanks. I was interested in how it came about that she was thought of and hired to direct the show, if someone from DTC had seen some of her work somewhere else.
Well, you've been here before.
Yes, I've been here before. Kevin Moriarty, the artistic director, actually has known me for quite a while. He is a graduate of Trinity Rep Conservatory, which is where I went to school, and he came back to direct the students. And I was one of those students. I played a lead in a show that he directed, and that's when we first got to know each other. And then one of my first big projects was called The Good Negro by Tracy Scott Wilson, about the civil rights movement. He and Oscar Eustace at the Public Theater in New York co-wrote it, and I premiered it. The world premiere was at Dallas Theater Center. And that was really the beginning of my professional career, honestly. That production and that co-production kind of put me on the radar as a professional director. So I have a lot of love for Kevin Moriarty and for Dallas Theater Center. And he's asked me to come back repeatedly since that first production, but just because of scheduling, it wasn't really possible. And then he offered me Les Mis, which is absolutely an offer I couldn't refuse. And so, we just figured out how to make it happen. And that's how that happened. And he saw a production of a musical I did at Oregon Shakespeare Festival called Party People, which was about the Black Panther movement. And it was, about American Revolution. And I think he thought, after seeing that I would be able to do a kind of fresh take on Les Mis and really kind of grasp the themes that are central to Les Mis in a way that the audience might really respond to.
Is there anything about this story that you did struggle with that somehow didn't strike you, just based on the source material or something in your own personal experience that was hard for you to swallow and work with?
Not really. I mean, you do, as I said earlier, you have to come to terms with the parts of the novel that are, that you're like, oh, I wish that was in there. That's so rich. But then there's other rich things that already exist. So not really. I mean, the hardest thing for me was sort of tackling some of the female characters, because some of them can feel very dated, particularly Cosette, because, she's sort of an ingenue with that we don't really get to know very well. The actress playing Cosette, Dorcas Lung, and I had a series of conversations about, as well as Jacob, the costume designer, about like how to make her not feel kind of like a one-dimensional pretty girl. Because I absolutely did not want to just create this little princess in a tower. I wanted her to feel like someone that girls watching today could admire or want to be like, not just a kind of distant pretty girl that the boys all like. So we really broke down, okay, what is her life? Her life is sitting at home with her dad, reading books all the time. She doesn't have any friends. She doesn't go out. He's kept her completely protected because he's so afraid of something bad happening to them. So we just sort of translated that to a girl today, and we kind of made her a little geekier than she normally is. And Dorcas is incredibly beautiful. She's a gorgeous young woman. But she's, she's very quirky and very funny. And so we figured out to like lean more into the quirky and funny than into the gorgeous young girl world of the character. And that ended up being a really fun journey, a little worrying in the beginning. But then we all feel really proud of the Cosette that we have on stage. And I feel really good about young girls seeing that version of Cosette and relating to them, to her.
There are a lot of works of a certain age in which, like, the main character's primary secret is something that no longer is an issue today, right? There's someone who can't possibly be married because their older sister is not married yet, or they can't, they can't tell their daughter that they once did. These days we're so confessional. How do you make that feel real when the tension between Jean Valjean and Cosette is that he just can't tell her these things, even though at the end of the day he did a pretty amazing and honorable thing?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's the one scene between Jean Valjean and Marius, who's played by Justin Keyes. There's a wonderful little scene where Jean Valjean basically confesses who he is and says, I have to leave and you have to take care of Cosette. And Marius is like, why do you have to leave? She's going to be really sad. Please don't leave. And he says, I have to protect her. I have to protect her reputation, because if this comes out, it'll damage her. And that is obviously, purely period. In this day and age, if a father confesses that he was a convict and no one knew about it, it's not going to, really deeply affect a 20-something's woman's reputation. It's going to be fine. So that's one of those moments where you just kind of have to really talk through it and figure out how to commit to it and how to, how to make it believable. And that's always sort of one of those annoying moments in a rehearsal process where you just have to take time to make sense of that. Mm-hmm. But then you just do it with commitment and people buy it. But I think it's harder on us, the the theater makers, because we have to kind of deconstruct it and then reconstruct it.
Yeah.
But people, you know, people seem to be fine with it.
On the other hand, a problem that feels so contemporary, and I suppose it was back then, you know, we've done a number of programs on this show about how hard it is, even after you've done your time, to get a job and mm-hmm. to get trusted to mm-hmm. be a member of society. And it forces so many people back into a life of crime because they can't get an apartment, they can't get a job at McDonald's. And exactly that is happening to Jean Valjean. And that feels very much like today.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, you know, and that's why the prison images, I probably feel the most contemporary in some ways, because I felt like that is as relevant today as anything in, you know, a movie made last year. You know what I mean? And that whole, what we call the epilogue, the prologue is about the first 40 pages. It's basically about his journey after getting out of jail and feeling like doors are just shut in his face because he's a con. And that is, you know, and so much rejection and so much self-loathing happens to this man that he ends up committing another crime and almost goes to jail except for the, you know, an act of God. That's something we talked about a lot. It's just that is what recidivism is, isn't it? And that happens today.
Is it helpful that most members of the audience know every line of dialogue, so that although you obviously want and achieved great diction from your actors, it's not the most important thing?
I don't know. I feel like it's pretty important. I mean, I kind of hound them every single day about diction and clarity. And, you know, the hardest part of previews is just getting, because of we don't always get to rehearse with the band as much. Mm-hmm. That big part of previews in a big musical is just getting the balances between the band and the singers to be, you know, this is where the sound designer, the sound team have to work their butts off, because it's a massive amount of sound design that has to happen. So I feel really strongly about diction, and I hope that by the time we get to opening, you know, because I feel about diction in a musical the way I feel about Shakespeare, which is when I work on Shakespeare, sometimes you get a sense of, you know, the audience kind of generally understanding what things mean, but that's not good enough for me. The goal is not to get the gist of the idea. Mm-hmm. The goal is to actually get the idea. And that's the same with a musical. It's a process. It doesn't happen immediately because there's just so many technical elements that go into it. So I think, you know, we'll fight that fight till the very last minute.
What are we to make of the fact that Les Misérables ends on a sort of, a kind of happy, joyful note, and yet the revolution was a bust, right? I mean, what do we do with that?
I don't think it ends on a joyful note, because the final lyrics
resolve,
are about,
maybe is the word.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is one of those things where the revolution is a bust, everybody dies, and then Marius marries his girlfriend. And you know, we've tried to kind of create a subdued wedding, and then the Thénardiers come in and they mess everything up. But the epilogue, which is when everybody comes in and sings together, is in a way almost Brechtian, because they all just turn to the audience and say, will you join in our crusade? You know, will you basically think about your fellow man, think about what you see in front of you, and try to do something? And it's almost like they break out of character and just turn to the audience and like implore them to be more conscious in the world. And, you know, that's a fascinating choice on the part of the original writers, you know, to use the last part of the play as a piece of activism. So that's definitely still in process for us, because I'm reconfiguring the beggars scene right now. So what people have seen on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday is going to be very, very different in the coming days, and that's going to influence what the epilogue is, because I'm trying to really kind of dig into the intention of the writers with that sense of the characters turning to the audience and kind of using the music as a way of asking them to wake up. I mean, that's what's in the writing. And I don't feel like I've actually really nailed that moment yet. So that's the next 3 days of work for me.
The Thénardiers are really interesting. They're always interesting characters because you sort of go back and forth between finding them to be like lovable scamps and really dangerous, sadistic characters, particularly the man.
Yeah,
I don't know his first name. So you just when you decided how you should feel about them, you change your mind.
Yes, and no, it is interesting because we have the, you know, the sort of delight of the innkeeper scene, which is a number basically.
Yeah.
And then they turn into these real animals in Paris, you know. And we've talked with the costume designer, and I talked about, you know, so there are these kind of colorful characters, ne'er-do-wells in the innkeeper scene, and then fast forward 10 years to Paris, and they lead a gang of murderers and cutthroats, and they steal from people and they beat people up, and it's, you know, and it's what I thought about it is what happens with sort of rural crime and urban crime, right? Mm-hmm. Urban crime. So they move themselves to the city and they thought they would do better, but in fact they've sunk because it's way more competitive. There's more people. It's more, you know, and the kind nature of crime is much more brutal. And because they're survivors, they've just joined into that world and they've reformed themselves into gangsters, basically. And, you know, they've definitely fallen on harder times because life in an urban environment is much more intense if you're poor, in terms of the way that Les Mis is structured. And so they become even, you know, worse versions of themselves. But then there is kind of strange final scene where they come to the wedding and then they kind of sing a funny song, which the audience loves. You know, so I'm not going to, I've made a decision not to mess with that final song. I think it's there for a reason. We've put the audience through a lot of emotional turmoil, and I feel like they need
a break.
That breath of laughter.
I do love, it's a brilliant bit of costume design that while Jean Valjean spends, you know, the entire show trying to cover up his prison tattoo, yeah, that Thénardier's costume is cut so that he can show off his like prison numbers. I thought that was brilliant. I've not seen that before, and I thought it was great.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, we I mean, because I feel like the three kind of stories that we're following are Thénardier, Javert, and Jean Valjean, and they all have such different ways of attacking life as well as spirituality. Because Thénardier and I, because I feel like every single man has a moment of, you know, those men have a moment where they are alone and they talk to God. And what Thénardier says in his moment alone is that God is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that to me is not something that you throw away. That's a serious component of the storytelling of the whole play and of these three men, how very different their relationship to God is.
Do you have a favorite line?
Oh my gosh. You know, that every single day I pretty much had a new favorite line.
Mm-hmm.
I can't choose one. There's so much that I love.
It's okay. I won't put you on the spot. And I know this was like your one day off and God knows how many. So thank you so much for making time for us.
It's a pleasure, an absolute pleasure.
Lisa Tommy directs the Dallas Theater Center production of Les Miserables. The show is in previews now. It opens July 4th and runs through August 17th. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.